Welcome to the Seattle Kitchen Show on Kiowa Radio 97.3 FM. It's the chef from the chapeau.
Yes, Mr. Douglas.
How are you, sir?
Fabulous, fabulous. It's a beautiful, gloomy day out there. And it's, you know, just love to be in this city. And I know that all that water is going to pay off in the summertime.
Exactly. It's going to wet our garden.
That is correct. Mm-hmm. We'll have those gorgeous vegetables and lettuces and fruits and... Can't wait.
I'm Tom Douglas, chef owner here at the Hot Stove Society and owner of many of Seattle's fine restaurants, coming to you now in our 16th year, I believe it is. We started right about the first of the year, 16 years ago.
Sweet, sweet 16.
We started, they were building the viaduct, and we're still here and they're demolishing it.
We are located right above the Lola restaurant here at the Hotel Andre. If you ever want to come down, it's only $15. We have a full house this morning. And they're going to get, because they're special, they're going to get a breakfast sandwich. What do we have today for our special guest, Miss Sarah?
We have three different options from the wonderful Dahlia Bakery. They could get a bacon breakfast sandwich, a ham, or a mushroom.
Wow, this is a big morning here at the Hot Stove.
It certainly is.
And Katie O here, marketing director for Molly Moon Ice Cream.
That's right. Hi.
Former co-worker of ours here at Tom Douglas Restaurant.
Some of the best times of my life, Tom.
In those important kind of building times when you became the woman you are.
Look at me now. Yeah. Look at me now. Here I am. Yeah.
She's flying on her own.
All right. Today on the show, we have Chef Mary White is here to tell us about cooking with cannabis. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not a big cannabis user. None at all.
Legal and at all, but still no.
Even though it's legal, yeah, yep. It's just not my thing. I much prefer whiskey or red wine.
That's true.
I've been cooking with this for quite some time.
Have you?
Whiskey, yes. And red wine.
Yeah, exactly. Sarah's going to learn how to make tiki cocktails from Angela Buck Hatter. She's a bartender here at Lola. And we're going to share our favorite taste of the week, both at home and around town. And, of course, it's at the end of our 2 hours. It's food for thought, tasty trivia, where Tom Douglas wins and you all lose.
That's right. I have been losing a lot lately.
I like it.
Yes, I think it's because you all are jinxing me.
I like that.
Yeah, I know you do.
Can't tell you how much it excites me. All right, but first let's jump into ordinary to extraordinary.
Yes, the first ordinary dish that we are going to make extraordinary actually comes from one of our listeners on our Facebook page, Cassie McDougall, and she wants to know how to make an extraordinary vegetable stock. We were talking about chicken stocks last week, and we've certainly talked about other meaty stocks before, but how to get that same delicious umami savory flavor from a vegetable stock?
I think you need to start by caramelizing some onion, and if you have that adds a layer of flavor. Mm-hmm. Same with the other vegetable, the carrots, the celery. Make sure you give them a nice little sear to those vegetables so you actually have an extra layer of flavor. Your stock will not be as clear or transparent, but that means it has more flavor in it. So that, and also fresh herbs, beautiful thyme, bay leaf, herbs that can last for at least 35 minutes cooking, because that's how long it takes to cook for vegetable stock, about 30 to 45 mm-hmm. minutes, you know, maximum. You don't want to cook a vegetable stock too long, because there is only so much extraction you can do from vegetables boiling, and then after that it's...
Well, they start to break down and make the whole thing cloudy and become soup.
Soup,
yeah,
which is also delicious.
The only thing I would say to chef, I would say a little bit harder than caramelization for me. I will literally take those onions halves and I'll put them on almost like you're in a cast iron pan and just char the heck out of them.
Sear them.
And that's that really dark flavor that you can get out of a vegetable stock. If you just want a bright broth, then don't do that.
Right.
Yeah.
I was just being a little bit more delicate.
Yeah. It becomes you. You do have an eau de toilette.
Yeah, I do have an eau de toilette, exactly.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. All right. The next dish we have is lentils. A lot of people are cleaning up their diets in January, just after a lot of indulgences from the holidays. And so they're starting to pull out grains and lentils and beans and all these delicious ways to eat just a little more healthfully.
I thought you said brains. It's like
brains
and lentils.
Green lentils. An onion, couple of cloves stuck into the onions, bay leaf, put that together, a little salt, cook your lentils gently with a ham hock. And I tell you, you're watching a movie and eating some lentils and then a ham hock, it's delicious. You need Gone with the Wind, though, because it takes 3 hours to eat the damn
thing. No, it's because it gives you the wind. This is why you need...
Is that true, Tom? Are you giving us a little insight?
Well, I don't know. I'm not a big legume.
Oh, I love lentils.
I'm just saying they give you the wind.
You know, you can also have it with duck confit, which is always a good idea. Right. You know, cook your lentils on the side, cook your duck confit on the side, put the two together at the last minute, serve that with some nice grilled bread. Mmm.
Yeah, I would only eat that if you served it with those good French duck fried potatoes.
Oh, of course. Oh, lentil and potatoes
lentil
together?
Lentil and potatoes. Yeah, exactly.
I don't see
then
why
we
you
wonder
wouldn't.
Why we're like
why
this.
Not?
Why wouldn't you? We are making ordinary things extraordinary.
You need to get a good crispy skin, though, on your duck confit.
That is true. All right. Tom, how about spaghetti and meatballs? How do you make an extraordinary version of spaghetti and meatballs?
That young man that just walked by has a set of lips on his neck. I like that.
Oh, the tattoo? Tattoo?
You couldn't see that on the radio, but I'm just saying. He's very handsome. I'm so distracted. What did
I know.
You say?
I was looking at the meat he was carrying, but yes.
So here's what I do for my meatballs that I think makes them a little bit different than, say, just a beef meatball. So I use a pound of veal, a pound of beef, and a pound of Italian sausage.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of my base meat for the meatballs.
Pork, beef, and
then I always add all the typical things like some Tabasco and tomato paste and some anchovy and all that sort of thing. But I always like my meatballs a little cheesy.
Hold on, Tom.
So I chop mozzarella and put it in there so that when you brown the meatballs, the mozzarella kind of drips out of your meatball and browns up.
You're kind of making a mix between a meatball and an arancini.
You said, my dear, to make it extraordinary.
No, I know. I'm just saying, like, this. It sounds delicious. I'm not arguing.
You did mention anchovies. Do you want to clarify?
Yeah, a little anchovy paste. Umami.
Yeah.
You just don't know they're in there, but it's that layer of flavor that's kind of, wow, what is this so good for?
That's a chef touch right there.
Yeah, a little tomato paste, a little anchovy paste.
Secrets. Mm-hmm. Secrets from the
that
pantry.
Makes you.
And it has, like I said, all the regular things like eggs and breadcrumbs and garlic and mustard and Tabasco. But it's the cheesy, the melty cheesy thing.
This is how you clean your pantry.
Yeah, why not?
So when you go through the trouble of making those delicious sounding meatballs, what do you do for your sauce? Keep it pretty simple?
Yeah, just a tomato sauce.
Just a regular
The meatballs are the
sauce.
Star.
That's right.
Right? So just, you don't need to do anything else with your sauce. Sean's calling us to hurry up. Okay, up next, KDO is hosting a dinner party, and we're going to cook it, because that's what we do for
that's
you.
Right.
We love you. We're using the same ingredient in every course on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen Show. I'm Tom Douglas.
And I'm Thierry Rotiro, the chef in a hat.
And I'm KDO.
And KDO, it's time for dinner party.
Yeah.
And it seems like I got myself into some hot water again last week.
It's those strong opinions that you like to express.
What's strong opinion? An opinion?
Nothing. There's nothing wrong with having an
opinion.
Nothing,
but you have to be willing to listen to the other part of the story.
That's right. So we went to our Facebook page, Seattle Kitchen, after you ranted. I'm going to call it a rant. You ranted about boneless, skinless chicken breasts.
Mm-hmm.
And like, why would anyone ever purchase, eat, do anything with a boneless, skinless chicken breast? And, you know, we had a guest on the microphone that I think you maybe made feel a little bit bad about his choices. Point is...
That certainly wasn't or was intentional.
Yes, was or wasn't. We'll never know. But
he made out pretty good, though. Didn't he get a set of knives?
He did really well.
Yeah, and you know what? He was a good pal about it. He's a good sport.
And he said he was going to try the version that Tom offered as a suggestion.
But one of our esteemed listeners, David Feaster, says, so this begs the question, what would Chef Tom Douglas and Chef Thierry Rotiro do to take the common bare, no-bone chicken breast from boring to brilliant? So, David
I would
Feaster.
I would wrap it in a skin-on thigh.
You'd Frankenstein.
Boneless.
No.
Okay.
You've made it clear that you don't like it. But we want to see what you would actually do with it to make it delicious if you have these feelings. And so we're going to host a dinner party. David Feaster is going to be our guest at this dinner party that we're constructing here. And so I'm sure he'll let us know.
Critic and judge.
Yeah, I'm sure he'll let us know if it sounds delicious at the end of the day on our Facebook page. But we are going to do a whole dinner party.
All right, I'm going to start.
Chicken breast. Go.
So we talked about some of our favorite equipment in the kitchen that we never really use, but it's nice to have if you've got the space.
Yep.
And I have a dehydrator. So I'm going to take some of my delicious, I'm going to take some of my delicious Chinese 12 spice.
Okay.
And I'm going to take my chicken breast and I'm going to slice it across the grain. And then I'm going to pound it out really thin and I'm going to put my spice on it and some extra salt. And I'm going to put it in the dehydrator and make chicken, Chinese chicken jerky.
Delish. Almost like a van de flesh. Yeah,
and then I'm
going
to use that as a garnish for my shoyu martini with salted plums.
Well, I am impressed there, Tom
with
Douglas.
Salted plums, all right? So chicken jerky, spicy chicken jerky, salted plums, and shoyu martini.
You know, I got to say,
so
I'm
put that in your chicken pipe and smoke it.
I genuinely want the starter. Okay. A little shoyu martini. Yeah. Interesting.
I'll show you.
All right. Terry, that means you're up next.
Yes. I think I'm going to make a nice little chicken salad, but I'm going to take the breast.
Of course you are.
Of course I am. I'm gonna make a finger, a chicken finger, like slice the chicken breast in fingers, and I'm gonna marinate those in a little bit of soy, ginger, sesame oil. Ha! You didn't think I was going that way, did you?
I love it. You guys are going very Asian with these,
and then,
these chicken breasts.
Oh yeah, that's true. I'm going Asian too. Well, that's
fine.
The way it is.
There's nothing wrong with that.
Sealed in a sauté pan, really nicely finished with a little bit of honey.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to do some toasted walnut. This is where I get divorced from that. Toasted walnut crushed on top of that. Some sealed apple in a pan. And I'm going to do apple and sealed apple. They deglaze with a little bit of vinegar, white vinegar, or apple vinegar if you have any, which you should. And then put that on top of
a nice
little bed of lettuces and have a wonderful little chicken salad.
This sounds like, kind of like a teriyaki chicken salad.
Almost. With the apple and the walnuts and...
The walnuts changes things.
A teriyaki Waldorf chicken salad.
Put that on your menu at Lule.
Yeah, try that.
All right, Tom, you've got the main course with the chicken breast.
Well, we are in Asia, and Asia is a big area.
Mm.
So I'm going to do a...
Blood chicken stew.
Well, here's how you get your anger out at the boneless, skinless chicken breast. Is you take it and you just
pound it.
With a meat hammer. Just get your anger out. Just why didn't they buy
out
a thigh, is what I say. With every thwack of the hammer, I say, why didn't they buy a thigh? Why didn't they buy a thigh? Why didn't they buy a thigh? And then I'm going to make a paneer, because we have to give it some flavor somehow,
yeah,
right? So I'm going to make a spinach paneer. So just sear the chicken breast that's been beat to heck,
mm-hmm.
and in butter and ghee,
mm-hmm.
right? So just give it a hard sear with lots of cardamom and salt, hard sear. And then I'm going to take spinach, and I'm going to saute it down with a little coconut milk. And then I'm going to add paneer cheese, and then we're going to put it right over top. We're going to bathe our tasteless chicken breast in this spinach paneer. So
that sounds.
And we're going to serve it with some papadoms.
Okay.
Yeah, crunchy papadoms.
I just love the tasteless chicken breast. That's a nice way to put some flavor in it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, Terry.
It's a bathing rama, like thing.
How are you going to make a chicken breast dessert?
Well, you know what came first was the egg, so we're going to start with that.
We're going to bypass the chicken breast altogether.
Well, we'll go to the egg because...
It's boneless, skinless.
As long as you crack it and take the egg out, you're good.
That's a good point.
I'm just going to make a creme brulee and finish this wonderful meal on a high note. Vanilla creme brulee, and then be done with that. So for those of you who don't, I'm assuming everybody knows how to make a creme brulee, which is not true. So egg yolks, sugar, mix super well together. In the meantime, you have some cream on the fire that you just have some vanilla bean. I recommend vanilla bean because it makes a hell of a difference. Cut it
in
half.
Vanilla bean right now is about $10.
Well,
it's amazing.
How often do you make creme brulee?
I'm just saying, just a little side.
Yeah, well, one vanilla bean can make eight to ten creme brulee.
Yeah.
So don't be shy. You just transform that into a buck now. So you make your vanilla bean, cut it in half, put it in your cream. Make sure that at the end of your, once your cream comes to a boil, you scrape those vanilla beans so you get all the specks that are inside, because that's where the flavor is at. And then you pour that gently over your egg and sugar mixture. Bring it make sure you don't over-pour it too fast so you don't curdle the egg yolks. Pour it very slowly. Pour it back into a mold, into a cup, in a bain-marie. Put it in the oven covered at about 300 degrees, and within 45 minutes, you'll have a ready-cooked crème brûlée. Then you take out, leave on the counter for 15 minutes, take it out of the bain-marie, let it rest, and then cool it down. Yes?
I want to know what temperature you're taking it out, because, you know, if you cook it too long, it curdles, right? So
right.
Is there a perfect temperature to take it out of the oven?
When you jiggle it,
yeah,
and you put your blade through the crème brûlée itself, it should come out, the blade should come out clean. That's the first easy task. The second one is when you jiggle it, it should be one piece, and it looks like it's together, almost like if you had gelatin in it. That's when you know it's ready.
What about if you had a digital thermometer?
Oh, you're sophisticated. Just kidding.
I
would say
175, 185.
Yeah, 180, 185, yeah. And then you let it sit on the counter for another 15 minutes in that water bath, so it just keeps on cooking. And you'll be fine.
Okay.
The most important part is don't turn your oven at 400 degrees because it will boil. And if it boils, it curdles. So that's the most important part of the crème brûlée part. And then sprinkle your sugar on top. Once it cooled off and once it's actually less than room temperature, you want to put your sugar on top. And then you want to burn it with a blowtorch. And if you don't have a blowtorch, well, I don't know what to do there. You could use an old piece of iron, round. And then you put it on the fire till it's bone red, and then you put it straight onto your sugar. That's how they used to make crème brûlée. That's how it was invented. So,
but you can do it under the broiler in your oven, too.
Well, the problem with putting under the broiler is by the time your sugar gets cooked, your top of your crème brûlée becomes curdled because it's too high of a heat, too close of a general heat, so it actually warms up and breaks down the flan. So,
all right.
Not the perfect tool, the broiler.
There you go, whoever was challenging us on the boneless skin.
David.
So next week, we might even break down a chicken and show you why you could do so many better things with it.
We'll show you on the radio.
Mary J. White is here with her new book, Everyday Mary J., A Practical Guide to Cooking with Cannabis, up next on Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. We are set. We're back in the Seattle kitchen on Cairo Radio. I'm Tom Douglas.
I'm Terry Rotiro, the chef in the hat.
And I'm Katie O.
And Mary J. White is here with us. Not Miss Blige, but Mary J. White is
not
here.
Mary Jane White necessarily well, either. Are you a Jane?
Mary Jane.
It's actually Mary Jacqueline White.
Okay.
Mary so Mary J. is perfect.
Just
it's
like
perfect.
My wife.
Yeah.
Jacqueline.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. See?
Anyway, you've got a new book called A Practical Guide to Cooking with Cannabis.
Yeah, the actual title is Everyday Mary J, because that's how often I think you ought to use the medicine.
Uh-huh.
But it's a practical guide because I've been teaching cooking with cannabis for about 8 years. And so this isn't one of those chefy books, you know. It's more about practical ways to use, I'm calling it medicine, because that's what it is.
Are people finally getting, oops, sorry, Terry.
It's okay.
Are people finally getting over the drama that they think that you're going to get high if you use marijuana products?
Yeah, because we know so much more now about cannabis, and all the propaganda is kind of going away.
Well, we should start by saying THC versus CBD people understand the difference.
We're getting there, buddy. Yeah. We're getting there. Yeah. Because we're talking about three main types of cannabis.
Right.
So your CBD, which people are hugely into right now, is primarily one of the big cannabinoids that you find in the plant. Mm-hmm. So hemp, ruderalis, is almost pure CBD. There's no THC. So that is a wonderful thing to use for anxiety and stress and seizures and all that kind of stuff, right? But the THC that people are so concerned about is really important, because with cannabis, you have over 100 cannabinoids, and they all do something different to the body. And we're talking about an entourage effect. So I think what I'm trying to tell you guys is don't be scared of THC, because there's all these things in cannabis that work together, right?
I think where people get really concerned, and maybe your book clarifies this a little bit, is maybe at some point or another, someone went to a party, and someone made brownies, and there was an untold amount of THC, CBD, marijuana in that brownie, and they kind of had a bad experience. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's where some of the concern comes from, and the paranoia that can be associated with these unexpected times on the brownies.
Well, we're getting over it. That's all.
Well, and people are starting to understand that you're not going to go crazy and jump off a building. It cannot physically hurt you, unlike an opioid.
Right.
Because it doesn't affect the brainstem.
Right.
Yeah. So I'm more concerned. There's a lot of recipes in the book, obviously, but I mostly want to teach you guys why. Why would you want to use cannabis?
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
Yeah.
So I think that's the most important part in the in the whole story. I mean, there's been plenty and plenty of research about showing actually the benefits of CBD and THC as well. So,
let's have dinner.
Okay.
Let's have dinner with cannabis.
All right.
Or
cannabis.
Let's talk about the recipes in your book to make a dinner.
Okay.
Okay.
What I recommend when using cannabis is I don't normally have a dinner party with cannabis and everything.
But you can't.
Well, you can't because people are going to be in your damn sofa on Tuesday, you know? And that's not so good.
It is.
You know?
It's the guests that never left.
Yeah, exactly. They're all melted and stuff. But I like to do more like appetizers that are medicated if people are down with that, right? So there are recipes like majoun, which is a Moroccan compound. There's these cheddar stuffed olives. So good.
Yeah.
You know, there's dip, there's stuff like that. And what I like to do is have a little at the beginning, and then everybody's sort of happy by the entree, and then they get the hell out by dessert, you know?
Well, they're starving by the entree. So let's talk about the cheddar stuffed olive recipe.
Well, it's that kind of that cocktail vibe from the 50s. So you basically take a green olive and you cover it like in a cheese pastry, but in the cheese pastry is cannabis. Yeah.
I think my big question, and I think a lot of people have this question too, if you've ever cooked with cannabis at home, some people are familiar with extracting the medicinal properties through kind of low heat in butter more often than not.
Yes.
Is that really the way to do it? Is there a better way to do it? Are there different ways to do it?
That is a very good question, and I would say there's different ways to do it. What you're looking at is a medicinal plant with all this good stuff on it, right? And how do you get that stuff out of there?
Right.
So you can use heat and fat, or you can use cold and alcohol, which is how you make tinctures.
You can also use sugar and salt. I mean, there's like Ruby makes and infuse sugar and then infuse salt as well.
It's so easy.
Yeah, it's very simple and very easy to use.
Well, I mean, tell us how you do it.
You can just drop this in your coffee and drink your coffee and be done with that.
Yep. And what you do is the tincture that I'm talking about, the alcohol tincture, you put it on sugar and then dehydrate it back to sugar real slowly. And then you have beautiful sugar that's filled with cannabis.
Or you can just buy the package already made so you don't spend 3 hours doing that.
Yeah, you can. But that's the other thing, though, Terry, about making it yourself, is that once you get a little cannabis on board, you can make a ton of stuff.
You can dry paste fruit. You can do all kinds of different things.
You need to come over to my house.
Oh, yeah?
We'll play around. It'll be fun.
I'm all about the cooking part of it.
Yeah, me too. Well, and that's the thing. You know, people tend to think, oh, we're just going to be all high and wear dreadlocks and tie-dye. No. Mm-hmm. You can micro-dose, and that's what most people do. Because you got to function. You know, you don't want to be drooling and eating Cheetos. You know.
Especially when you're weak on the a lot of people don't take a lot and they don't need a lot.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the part that you need to control when you do your cooking.
Mm-hmm.
It's very important.
A little bit.
So, Mary, how do you control that? So, if you go to one of the larger stores, most edible products are probably going to be in a 5 milligram or 10 milligram dose.
Yeah.
And if you're new to ingesting, you know, cannabinoid products, edibles, you might be concerned that 5 might be too much or 10 might be too much. And so how do you determine the dosing when you're cooking at home?
There are many, many variables.
Yeah.
And the nice thing about starting at a dispensary is you can know, 5 milligrams, gives me a little bit of a hangover.
Uh-huh.
You know, cannabis is all about tolerance. And, of course, the more you use, the more you use. Because you just get better and better. But, okay, if you're making it at home, first of all, you need to know how much THC, basically, is in the cannabis that you have.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you get it at a dispensary, you know, half a gram for, or half an ounce, 14 grams, mm-hmm. it'll say X amount of percent. And then it gets real mathy and complicated. But it's not insurmountable.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if your cannabis has 100 milligrams, for example, and you're making 24 mini cupcakes, do the division.
Yeah.
You know? But the issue is when you grow your own, you have to kind of experiment.
Yeah.
Which can be fun.
I was going to say, could be a good time.
It can also be, you know, night-night.
Just a reminder, we're talking to Mary J. White. Her book is called Everyday Mary J., A Practical Guide to Cooking with Cannabis. I want to cook more.
Cook.
I know you're getting all technical.
Get in there.
Blah, blah, blah. But let's give me some recipes.
Okay. The wonderful thing about cooking with cannabis is once you figure out what works for you, you can put it in almost anything. Mm-hmm. So in the book, there's
and
stuff.
And just to stop for one second,
yeah.
Not all of it has to be inducing THC, right?
No, the other side
of cannabis.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Like if you extract from hemp, you're just going to get beautiful CBD products, and then you can use that in whatever you're making.
And why would you want to? That is also helpful?
Oh, CBD
yeah.
is wonderful.
Okay.
And if you don't want a high of any kind, or if you get tested at work, CBD can really help,
mm-hmm.
especially with, like I say, antispasmodic, anti-inflammatory, mm-hmm. PTSD,
okay.
you know. So what I like to do, like for entrees, usually you have to add your cannabis at the end because it's, you know, not tolerant to heat. But there's a chicken curry recipe in there that is really good. Meatloaf, chili, mm-hmm. soup, all that kind of stuff. You kind of add it at the end, almost like a garnish, like a little bit of pesto. Right?
Oh,
just
okay.
put that right on there, mm-hmm. right? And in baked goods, of course, it's inside.
But they're baked. Isn't that subject to heat issues, too?
Well, once you decarboxylate the cannabis, which you need to do before you work with it, and you just heat it to burn off the acid molecules, mm-hmm. but once you do that, it's stable. So you can use it. Now, I wouldn't stuff it under a chicken skin, because that would maybe be a waste, but I'd put it on there before mm-hmm. I served it.
Mm-hmm. Before you served it.
Yeah.
So I just have zero experience in this area, so obviously I have
Well, sounds like you and Terry and Mary are going to party down.
Yeah.
What about you? You have a lot of experience.
We need to start with a very small dose.
How dare you call me out on the radio show like that?
Oh, it was obvious, girl. We know you're getting baked all the time.
Every now and again,
yes.
I like to have a good time.
She's known to be in the pastry section quite often.
Oh, really? Yeah. I understand.
Once again, the conversation is around Mary J. White's new book, Everyday Mary J., Practical Guide to Cooking with Cannabis. Thank you so much for coming
thank
on.
Thank you, Tom. And you know, you can get the book at everydaymaryj.com.
Oh.
Easy, huh?
Selling it yourself.
Hell yeah.
All right. Coming up, we're going to talk with Louisa Haywood, who, if you remember, a longtime listener of this show,
yeah.
that Louisa was our intern a couple years ago. She's back from her semester abroad in Ireland and her studies at Cornell University. Right here on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. We are back in the Seattle kitchen at the Hot Stove Society. Time for our Taste of the Week, and we have a very special guest. I'm Tom Douglas, chef.
I'm Terry Rotiro, the chef in the hat.
And I'm Katie O.
And Louisa Haywood is here, and welcome back, number
one. Thank you so much for having me back.
For a long-time listener, she was on board with us for a while.
Yeah, she was an intern here. Not intern, but you did your senior high school project with us. Here at the Hot Stove.
Yes, I taught a cooking class.
Yeah, you went to the International School.
In Bellevue.
And how long ago was this?
I'm a junior in college now, so that was four years ago.
Oh, my God.
Scary. Mm-hmm. I said earlier, she's just growing up right in front of our eyes. Pretty soon, she'll be able to drink legally and play beer pong legally.
That's right. One week from now.
So you're at Cornell. You're studying. Are you still in human resources?
I study industrial and labor relations.
Industrial and labor.
Pre-law, employment law track.
Nice.
That feels very serious.
You know.
Well, we'll see if I stick with that.
Yeah.
I can claim to be anything right now.
We know you're a terrific cook. You did a class here at the Hot Stove as your senior project. And then we also know that you've spent your last 4 months in Ireland on your semester abroad. Is that true?
That's true. I lived in Dublin from August to December for a semester abroad doing a program for my major. Traveled all around Ireland, a little bit in Europe, but I wasn't gone every weekend, so I got to know Ireland and Dublin pretty well.
Fun. Did you feel about Dublin like I do? It's just a big frat party day in and day out, 7 days a week?
No. I mean, I think there are a lot of great pubs, and that's a lot of fun, but there's a lot more to that. It's a growing city. It's a tech city. Mm-hmm. It's kind of similar to Seattle because you see all the same logos on the buildings. But it's a very friendly group of people, and I met a lot of great friends there.
Yeah. Good. Mm-hmm. So you'll have a lifetime of traveling back and forth.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I want to be back on my spring break.
I want to know what you ate while you were
there.
Yeah,
me too.
There.
Definitely. I mean, when you think of Ireland, Irish food is, you think of like the beef and Guinness stew, a lot of heavy red meats or sausages and potatoes. But I would say what's really big in Ireland right now, in Dublin especially, they're having their burrito wars. So burritos are super popular. But no one's heard of a quesadilla, so I couldn't get anyone who
wait, say that again?
Burritos are really big in Dublin.
Right.
Burrito wars, so all these different burrito places that are tiny hole in the walls are competing for the best burrito. But no one has heard of a quesadilla.
And that's your thing, a quesadilla?
I would probably prefer a taco or a quesadilla.
Limited knowledge on Mexico. Well, pretty far away.
It's very funny how one item...
I know, it's
which
funny.
Is so random, like... That's very
funny. Sweden is big on tacos and hot dogs.
I know.
It's just kind of
weird.
I
invited people over to make quesadillas, and they said, oh, she's making quadzillas.
Is that Godzilla and something else with it?
I think King quesadillas, I think.
Very funny. So that was your favorite taste?
And no, I would say another thing about Dublin is it's a super big coffee city, kind of like Seattle. Mm. And I would say I became pretty attached to perfect lattes and scones, which are kind of different in the UK and Ireland. The scones are less sweet than in the US and more like a large biscuit. Mm. But I liked those a lot.
Did you? Are you a dipper? Are you a dunker?
No, I spread either clotted cream, butter, or jam. I like that.
And then dunk.
But to eat carefully, yeah.
That is delicious. Mm. That sounds like a really great way to spend a couple of months.
Yeah, let's hear your taste of the week.
When you got out to the country... Like down to Cork and areas like that, that is just super green. Did you get any of the dairy, any of the fresh seafood? I mean, when I was in Western Ireland down by Shannon in that area, so much of the chef world right now is around fresh seafood, kind of minimally prepared.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Cork has become, especially West Cork, has become quite a food city. They have multiple Michelin-starred restaurants in that city as of this year. Mm-hmm. And that is, the south of Ireland is that dairy land. So I did go to the Butter Museum in Cork. And then there are some, it is quite a big restaurant scene, and fish and chips down in Cork is pretty big as well.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. Okay, KDO, your taste of the week.
My taste of the week was made, I was on a girls' weekend getaway over on Whidbey Island, and we all took turns making meals. But lovely Cheryl and Robin pulled a recipe that was adapted from the Silver Palette, and it was chicken marbella. Do you know this recipe? Apparently it's an old 80s recipe.
I can't remember what it is exactly.
I'm probably the only person in this room that's been to the store that was the Silver Palette.
Really?
Yeah.
So do you know this recipe?
You've been there too on Columbus Avenue when it was open? Yeah.
Well, color me impressed. Mm-hmm. But I was really taken by this dish. It was something that seemed quite simple in a lot of ways. It was a marination of chicken, and there's capers and vinegar and prunes and olives and a lot of garlic. And then it's just simply baked. But it's kind of what I think of when I think of kind of North African flavors in a funny way, though, from the Silver Palette. And it was served with couscous. And I fell in love with it this weekend. I thought it was really, really delicious and a recipe accessible to all.
Lovely. It sounds fabulous.
Yeah.
And I imagine you could get that recipe still. I mean, that's one of the most popular cookbooks ever. So,
yeah, it's still there.
And speaking of North Africa, Anna Sartoon from Boston, who's famous for her North African cuisine and her book called Spice, is going to be joining me at the end of March. I want to say it's March 31st, quite literally, for brunch. We're going to do a little North African brunch at the Palace Ball.
Oh, cool.
During Washington Wine Week.
That sounds delightful.
And you, chef, your taste of the week.
Well, I made a little pot-au-feu this weekend, and just reminiscing about how great that dish is, and we don't make enough boiled beef and vegetable in our lives. You know, it was just simply done. I used a little beef neck and just tied it up like a roast and put it into a pot of water, just plain water with a couple of bay leaves, thyme. Yes?
When you say beef neck, bone in or bone out?
Out.
Bone out.
Bone out. Just the meat. You know, just
that seems
tied up.
Hard to bone out a beef neck.
It's a little bit of a trek.
Yeah.
Most of you out there buy it boned out for sure. You know. and it's definitely was a little pleasure to do that. And because I had the bone, put the bone in the stew as well, which added basically flavor from that bone. But I put the meat in there, bring it to a boil, skim all the scum, put all my vegetable, carrot, onion, turnips, parsnip, and then keep the cabbage on the side, and then bring that, cook that very slowly, add some coriander, peppercorn, all the traditional flavor, mm-hmm. parsley, stems into a bouquet garni kind of idea. And then just did it very traditional. And then at the end, I did the trick you were talking about, the onions burn. You know, my grandmother used to take a caramel piece of sugar cube between a big pair of pliers, you know, on the fireplace. She would light up and then put that in the cauldron to color the, to give that caramel color at the end of your pot-au-feu.
Wow.
But I didn't want to do that. I just took an onion and then really, really charred the onion and ended up with the same idea of coloring the, mm-hmm. and giving that caramel flavor at the end.
When I think of pot-au-feu, I think of it as being a variety of meats. Like some beef tongue, some beef neck.
No. Pot-au-feu is one.
Just one thing. So just like our pot roast.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Same idea, and then all those vegetables, and then you want to make sure that you put the vegetable in succession of cooking, so you don't want to end up with a puree. Like my mom used to put everything together.
Yeah.
Actually, she put the cabbage at the end, but you know, often everything was cooked to death, and we loved it as kids. But I've learned to like my vegetable crunchy now, so we don't cook it as long.
Okay. Sounds delicious.
But a garnish of cornichon, salt, and Dijon mustard. Mmm. I tell you, on a day like today, it's a fantastic dish to be sitting around.
And as soon as you can get it made, we'll have some for lunch.
Here we go.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Kind of you to offer. Up next, we're going to talk tropical fruits right here on Cairo Radio. Stay with us. We'll be right back. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show. We're smack dab in the middle of it. I'm Tom Douglas.
I'm Terry Rotiro, the chef in the hat.
And I am Katie O.
Let's talk tropical fruits. This is the time of year when we get to use things without guilt, right?
So let's go.
We're always preaching seasonality the rest of the year.
Right.
But we're in the middle of tropical fruit season. Very, very traditional. Even the kings and queens had orangeries and greenhouses for tropical fruits in the
mm-hmm,
wintertime.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So
let's go down the list of what we call tropical fruit to start with. Just a little quick list of what you can find on the market. Pineapple, mangoes, papayas.
Guavas.
Passion fruit, guava.
Coconut.
Coconut.
Limes, lemons.
Oranges.
Finger limes.
Those Buddha hands.
Star
those
fruit.
Crazy Buddha hands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Cambazola? What is that star fruit?
That sounds like a cheese, Cambazola.
No, it's like a... What's the other name for star fruit, the real name
Cambola.
For
it? Cambola is a name for cheese, you're right.
Yeah, I know it is, but it's also close to the star fruit.
I don't know, you're trying
anyway,
to be too fancy.
Pineapple, let's start there, because I think everyone... the problem with pineapple is it's such a big piece of fruit, right?
Right.
So that if you don't often buy one, if you're just a single or just even a duo... unless you know how to IQF it. So, you know, you take the pineapple that you can use, you use it. I am a big fan of overripe.
Yes, me too.
I shouldn't say overripe, but at least ripe pineapple.
Correct.
Green pineapple does not do it for mm-hmm. me.
So how do you ripen your pineapple if it's not entirely ripe when you get it?
I stare at it.
You turn it upside
for
down.
Weeks.
You turn it upside down and you leave it on your counter for a few days.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the tricks I learned from Hawaii.
How do you turn it upside down, though? Doesn't
it
have all the fronds?
You can't just put it standing up just like that. You got to put it against something, obviously. on your counter against the wall.
Buffer
obviously.
It with like wine bottles against the wall. That's
yeah,
what you,
or just put it in a vase. Just put the top it, in a vase and
yeah, well, exactly.
There you go.
Here we go.
Here we go.
Doesn't
vase.
Seem that difficult. No. Anyway, so then for me, how I clean a pineapple is I whack the green part off the top.
Right.
I whack a little bit off the bottom.
Right.
And then I take my serrated knife and I go all the way around the outside.
Right.
Now I've got a naked pineapple. But I still have to get the core out if I'm going to chunk it, right? So then right. I just cut it in quarters, and then I take my knife and I run that down and take the core out.
If your pineapple is really ripe, you can take that core and actually cook it down slowly. It will be very nice and tender. You don't have to throw it away.
And what would you use that cooked pineapple for?
Just like dice it and just use it with everything else you're doing. If you're doing an upside-down cake, let's say a pineapple upside-down cake, you can use... That as a garnish, you dice it small and use it as a garnish around the cake, and it's perfectly edible. It's very tender.
How do I put my maraschino cherry in the middle of it?
Very carefully.
Very carefully. All right, papaya.
Oh, I was going to say, can I interject and ask about passion fruit?
Sure. Yes,
I love that flavor. I see it in the markets. I just saw it at my little co-op and thought, I don't know what to do with that.
So, you buy the passion fruit, make sure it's ripe, and then you can cap the top.
How do you make sure it's ripe?
So, it needs to be soft a little bit. It needs to have some give, because if it's hard as a rock, it is definitely not ripe.
Okay.
So, give like a ripe avocado?
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly. Same kind of texture. When you press on it, it needs to give a little bit, because if it doesn't give, it's not ripe.
But you don't want it to be a big old ball of mush, necessarily.
No, obviously not. Obviously not. But
although, I wouldn't say that would hurt it. It's
no,
a little
that
bit
would
like
not,
persimmon that way,
correct,
right?
It's, correct. It's not going to hurt it. You're going to have a shell that's going to be a lot softer on the outside. It's going to be, obviously, the product inside is going to be riper. But, so what I would do is cap the top, empty the meat, the pulp that's in there.
The pulp?
And then make either a souffle or something simple like that. Mm-hmm. Or, I did that one year at Rovers for New Year's Eve. That was quite a hit. But it was the major pain in the patootie, so I wouldn't recommend it for everybody. But you could make something as simple as a pastry cream, which is basically egg yolks, sugar mixed together, cream, bring to a boil with vanilla bean, pour gently onto the egg texture, and then a little flour in there, and then cook the whole thing down on the fire until it's totally thick, and then put it aside, cool it down a little bit, and when it's room temp, mix it with your puree of passion fruit. Now you have a passion fruit curd kind of base.
Oh.
And then you can put that back into the egg. I'm picking eggs.
Yeah.
Because it looks like an egg. But you can put that back into the passion fruit shell. And you have a wonderful little presentation, a nice little dessert. Top with a little bit of French meringue on top. Burn the whole cap. You got a Martha Stewart dessert right there.
Oh.
Martha Stewart dessert right there.
Hmm. What other one are you curious about? Bananas?
By the way, passion fruit makes a fantastic acid for dressing. Mm. If you're doing, let's say, a little lamachi, crudo, or whatever, it's nice to use passion fruit juice, you know, the pulp.
Yeah.
You blend it gently and you pass it through a fine strainer and you have this gorgeous juice. Then you can mix with just a little dash of olive oil and regular canola oil or peanut oil like Tom was going to use earlier. And then you mix that together and season gently as in not too much salt, not too much pepper, and then put that right on top of your amachi, brush it on your amachi. It's delicious.
There are a few tropical fruits that I see at, say, Asian grocery stores that when I have them, I think, wow, what a neat-looking fruit.
Mm-hmm.
And then I taste it, I'm like, wow. This doesn't have a ton of flavor
good.
To me.
Well, one of those would be green papaya, right?
Green papaya.
Yeah.
I would also put dragon fruit in that category. Mm-hmm. And I have rarely ever had a piece of star fruit that I was like, wow, star fruit. Mm-hmm. You are real cute, but you're not bringing much to the flavor table. So what to do with these really interesting looking fruits that maybe don't yield a lot of taste?
Well, the one I use the most is green papaya because I think it makes a great crunchy salad to go with, say, shrimp toast or some other specialty food like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I just take it, I peel it, shred it on a julienne grater, like a Japanese
like a mandolin.
Mandolin.
Mm-hmm.
And then I make a dressing for it, a classic nguok cham. So fish sauce, a little lime juice, a little just a little bit of sugar, some rice vinegar, a mirin rice vinegar mix yeah. would be fine with that. But and then I think the key is the fresh herbs. So fresh julienne mint, fresh julienne Thai basil,
cilantro,
and then finish with some toasted shallots on top. Yum. And you have what is a very plain, almost tasteless fruit. Tastes like...
But that texture is so good.
Tastes like the Mars landing.
Yeah.
It's like so unexpected.
It's weightless.
It's, yeah, it's just...
The
it's
Mars
like,
landing.
It's like the Mars landing. It's like a green papaya rock.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Because like Martians are green.
For sure. If yeah. anything that we've seen from the Area 51 photos and mm-hmm. the National Enquirer, they are definitely green or
they,
silver. We don't
they
know.
Must eat green papaya. Yeah. I mean,
for sure.
That's it.
Anyway,
mangoes?
That's mine, green papaya. No, we got to be done.
No, we
got
to be done? Okay.
We'll Next be time. Right back on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. It's time for pina coladas, Mai Tais,
zombies.
Guava punch, zombies,
hurricanes.
Sarah, our production manager here, has... or is going to take a class with Angela Buck Hatter here from the Lola Bar program. She's teaching here at the Hot Stove. What are you most interested to learn when you take this class tomorrow?
Oh, man, really anything about any of this? I am not a person who has really made many mixed drinks. Mm-hmm. Like, I can put alcohol into another drink and call it a mixed drink. But
rum and coke.
Yeah, you know, rum and coke. Yeah. Throwing
Gin
some Baileys in hot chocolate. Things like that.
Yeah.
But actually being able to make something like a Mai Tai or really just any of these is super exciting. I know a lot of people are doing dry Januaries, but it's cold and depressing outside, and it seemed like a really good time to learn how to make a Mai Tai.
All right. You know, it's all about the glassware. Just got to find some sort of coconut glass and some mermaid glass or
well,
something.
Well, and
like that.
The garnishes.
All right, let's listen in.
Hi, my name is Angela Buck Hatter. I've been a bartender for roughly 15 years. I'm an educator at the Hot Stove Society, teaching cocktail, ranges from historic cocktails to tiki, and also some of my own signature drinks. When learning anything, I always think, you know, start with the classics. And in doing so, you want to kind of go to the beginning of tiki, which started in the late 1930s. And there's kind of three forefathers of that movement. And whenever I think tiki drink, I think Mai Tai. And Trader Vic's recipe is kind of the go-to, that the gold standard, I would say. So, yeah, on that note, Don Beach being the founder of the whole movement is actually from Texas, raised in New Orleans, and spent most of his adult life in Los Angeles. And he, however, after kind of exploring the South Pacific, came back to Los Angeles and created this movement, the Tiki Movement. So he kind of came up with the whole concept. His restaurants kind of had a formula to them. It was not only about the drinks, it was about the decor and feeling like you're being whisked away to another place. And we're not even quite sure where that place was specifically, but it had a tropical feel to it. It had a feel of the South Pacific being maybe lost at sea and finding a desert island, and this would be the structure or place where you would end up. He had a lot of fun gimmicks. As far as a businessman, he, you know, they're in California, and he actually installed little water spigots outside the windows to make it look as if it was raining. And when he did so, would turn these on, people would stay inside and continue to drink, and they didn't want to leave because it was raining. So he was a very smart businessman, and definitely made his mark. He also collected different items to feature in his restaurant and had fishing nets and lighting. And so it really did make you feel as if you were somewhere very exotic.
Well, it does kind of seem like the perfect drink for now in that case. We could also, I think he's a tropical island. So should we try mixing
the
drink?
Absolutely. Sounds great. Whenever I think tiki drink, I think Mai Tai. This is one of those drinks that really gets lost in translation, I think, a lot. And when you order it at a bar, you actually don't know exactly the ingredients that are going to be put into it.
And why is it that you don't know what you'd be getting when you order a current one? Like, what have they changed about it?
I think that a lot of tropical drinks or tiki drinks, you would think of just being like Kool-Aid and overly sweet and like really syrupy, like a melted popsicle, maybe. But now we're getting them and they're having more of the fresh juices and really natural flavors that are featured in the drinks. But if you go back to the beginning and you do a little bit of research, the recipe from Trader Vic is from 1944. And this recipe is actually the one that's kind of been perfected. And you're going to use two different types of rum in this drink. There's rum Clement VSOP, and this is kind of a French style of rum. However, you could use the Ray and Nephew overproof rum as well.
Why is that? Like, what do the different types add, or how do they interact with each other?
So I think that the lighter rum adds this kind of grassy note to it. This one is overproofed, so it adds a higher level of alcohol, so it evaporates faster as well. So you're smelling it in the nose more. And then a darker style of rum, as they go down, it's like the medium kind of golden rum is going to add kind of a caramely note to it. And then as they get darker, it becomes almost like blackstrap molasses flavors. You're going to get some baking spice in there as well. And just adds more of a level of complexity and more like of a baked fruit note even. Yeah. So it's 1 ounce of this rum. That's the Ray and Nephew. And then you're going to look for like an extra dark rum. Appleton Estate would do. And it's 1 ounce of this. It's actually an easy drink as far as proportioning goes. And then there's 1 ounce of lime juice. So all of three of those components are equal. Makes it easy to remember. And then there's a half ounce of the orgeat, which is kind of, it's an essential ingredient in the recipe. And basically it's an almond simple syrup, but it's made from pressing the almonds. And so the fat is released from the nut as well. And so it gives it this kind of cloudy color.
Where would you get orgeat?
So you can get it at your liquor store. I would go to like more of a specialty liquor store to find it. But you can also find it in places that sell perhaps like nicer syrups for coffee drinks. Yeah, would be there with your, you know, just your vanilla syrup that's for a coffee drink. It also has a little orange curacao. And we just need a quarter ounce of this one, as well as a little simple syrup. A quarter ounce of that as well. So, and if you don't have those ingredients, then you could use Cointreau, which is pretty easy to find, but basically you're looking for a citrusy or orange liqueur. So all of these ingredients are mixed together and then shaken with crushed ice. Most tiki drinks are shaken with crushed ice and then served over another large mound of crushed ice due to all the warm weather, right? You want to keep it cold. So if you don't have a fancy vintage crusher that has ice crusher that has a little crank on it, you can do it by hand with a wooden muddler or there's these nice little canvas bags that you can put your ice into and kind of whack it with your muddler as well. There we go. This particular one is served in a double old-fashioned glass. And then half a lime wedge as garnish. And then, of course, the little mint sprig. I give it a little slap. Kind of wakens up the the mint there, and that way, as you're drinking it, you're kind of smelling the bouquet of the herb. There you go.
Cheers.
Thank you. You are welcome.
Is it too early to drink?
That's a good question.
You're listening to Seattle Kitchen on Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM.
It's the Seattle Kitchen Show at the Hot Stove Society. We're back in the house for the Baker's Corner. I'm Tom Douglas.
I'm Terry Rotiro, the chef in the hat.
And I'm Katie O.
And strutting across the street. You know, this is kind of the time for the New Year Strutters Ball.
Yes.
You know,
with,
Alberta Hunter made famous in her song from Amtrak Blues. You don't know who Alberta Hunter is, do you?
We are. So
anybody in the audience know who Alberta Hunter is?
There's not a
you have missed. You have missed one of the fine songstresses of our.
I will go look her up right after this. I promise.
Of our century. Here's a quick story about Alberta. She was a great little torch singer, like when she was 20, 21, and then couldn't find work. I think during the Depression, and became a nurse. And when she was about 70, she got rediscovered, and became famous, or at least famous to me.
Her, yes.
Her album, Alberta Hunter's Amtrak Blues, is a classic. If you've never heard it, download it. Just saying. You can thank me later.
I will, yeah. Okay.
All right, we're in the Baker's Corner, and it's time. I had yesterday for lunch a dessert made with grapefruit.
Thank you for doing that.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm here in defense of pink grapefruit today.
Yeah, so yeah. It struck me that we don't talk about tropical fruits enough or citrus fruits enough when we have our Baker's Corner, so let's talk grapefruit.
Do it. Yes, I absolutely love pink grapefruit, mm-hmm. and I feel like it's kind of an underused ingredient. It's got a very delicate flavor. We all know what it tastes like. It's got this wonderful slight bitterness, sweet. It's beautiful to look at. But people don't really seem to go for it. They don't seem to order it. They don't seem to turn to it when they're baking at home. So I'm here to...
Yeah, it's not on the main drag for sure.
No, yeah.
Why is that? It's so delicious.
That's what I'm here to find out. Okay. It's absolutely delicious.
So what would you tell people to do? Now, I will tell you, my first thing is to make grapefruit, like sugared rinds.
Mm-hmm.
I love that. I think it's delicious
because
it's bitter and sweet
at
the same time. And then you can use those in fruit breads or in shortbreads, like little cookies, shortbread grapefruit cookies.
Makes great jelly. I mean, if you make a jelly of grapefruit, it's really delicious on top of pies, on top of different curd you can make.
That's what we had yesterday, the tart.
The tart, yeah. And the filling of that tart. So we have, what we did was take basically a key lime pie recipe and swapped out grapefruit juice for the key lime. So it's still got that sweetened condensed milk, creamy, almost sort of a curd consistency. And then we top it with a grapefruit gelée, which is grapefruit juice and gelatin. One thing I always do when I'm working with pink grapefruit is just add a little Campari.
Yeah.
Because that just kind of pumps up that wonderful bitter twang that you get. And like I mentioned, grapefruit is very delicate and it's very easy for other flavors, even just sugar, to sort of overpower that wonderful bitterness that you get. So a little Campari, I never drink it, but I use it for grapefruit all the time.
Campari on ice is actually nice.
Okay. Oh, I hope you get letters now. I get letters every time I say something like that.
Brittany's never going to be sponsored by Campari.
I will not. Well, I bake with it all the time. I think
you might want to change your rum.
I'm not going to sit there and drink
now,
it.
If I had a complaint about my tart yesterday, I want more filling.
More filling.
I wanted
good
more
to know.
Of that kind of the grapefruit
curd,
custard curd filling and reinforced with the grapefruit jelly on top.
So the custard is made just like a lemon custard?
Like a key lime pie filling, really.
Like
so you don't have to cook anything on the stove.
Right.
You're just mixing everything into a bowl, pouring it into your tart shell, and baking it for
delicious, sturdy tart shell.
Yeah.
I like with that custardy filling and then the jelly. It's a nice...
Caramelizing grapefruit too is a good, you know, when you can blowtorch caramel, put sugar on top of grapefruit and then caramelize it. It's really good.
I'd say that's my top three favorite ways to eat grapefruit in a dessert setting. First of all, grapefruit segments, they're the easiest to segment of all the citrus.
Fruit.
They're so huge. I like to take that, then take those segments and just dry them out a little bit, whether you put them on a rack in a lowest temperature oven for 10 minutes or a food dehydrator for a little bit, or just leave them out. Just pull a little bit of that moisture out.
Never heard that.
Yeah, and then once you coat it with sugar, the sugar really clings to it. It doesn't dissolve on impact with the juice, and then you can get a really beautiful caramelized sugar shell on the outside, and it's just...
And then using...
So that's just like a brûlée.
A brûlée grapefruit, so simple, yeah.
And if you have enough time in your life, you can just break down all the segments into little... Almost like caviar dub, dollop, you know, kind of
idea. Actually take the Supremes and break those down?
Yeah, and then you end up with those little pearl of grapefruit, and you can sprinkle that through your custard.
Which is even easier to do with a pomelo, which is a pink grapefruit's mama. True. Yeah.
Here's another bigger grapefruit.
Exactly.
And where does the ugly fruit fit in that mix?
You know, I've not messed around with ugly fruit very much.
It's in my crossword all the time.
Is it?
Like a form of grapefruit or, you know, blah, 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 and they call it ugly fruit.
Well, pink grapefruit certainly is not ugly.
No, it's not.
I think the flavor of pink grapefruit wins on all those three different ones.
Yeah.
The flavor is so delicious.
Yeah.
And the juice and all that is so good.
Absolutely.
But the big secret, I think, in grapefruit is to not use the pith.
Don't use the pith.
That will kill the flavor of everything into your dish.
It's got a very thick pith, and it's not delicious. If you guys don't, if you want to work with pink grapefruit, you want to get at that zest, please invest in a microplane.
Yeah.
I'm sure you guys remember the world before microplanes, but it was awful.
Not so good.
What are you saying?
I remember the world before microplanes.
Dinosaurs.
Yes.
Remember what that was.
In my early days in my career, we did not have microplanes, and they changed everything.
Speaking of dinosaurs, I'll just add one thing to your segment. No pun intended. When you talked about the brûlée grapefruit, the first time I ever had that was at the Stanley Park Tea House. In Vancouver, up in Stanley Park.
Yeah, I remember that.
And they were famous for their half grapefruit brûlée on the top.
Mm-hmm.
And I've used that technique on everything.
So
blood orange, limes,
lemons. I'll give you a little trick. You take a half grapefruit, you burn it, caramelized.
And with sugar.
You sprinkle sugar. Brown sugar is good. You burn that, and then you take that and you squeeze that into your gin.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, man. That makes a good cocktail.
I'm doing that.
All right, you were heading somewhere.
I was going to talk about when you're using the zest, say in baking, if you want to make a grapefruit pound cake, please do. It's delicious. Or if you're going to make a lemon poppy seed muffin, swap out the lemons and do grapefruits. Zest that grapefruit directly into your sugar and then take your very clean hands and rub it into the sugar. That really intensifies the flavor. And that way you're making sure you're not letting any of that wonderful grapefruit flavor go to waste. And then your hands will smell delicious as well.
Here's a question I have.
Mm-hmm.
When I want zest, sometimes I want thicker zest.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'll take the peel, I'll take my serrated knife, and I'll go around the outside of the grapefruit and end up with a big peel with all the pith on it. And then I just take my little paring knife or a boning knife, and I peel the pith off from the inside.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, those are some knife skills.
And so then you've got, it's like taking the skin off a salmon or like, you know, where you're kind of just forcing your knife away from the zest itself.
Yeah.
But you get all that pith off, and now you can just julienne the grapefruit zest. And you end up with a much thicker strip and, in my mind, more flavorful because you're getting a bigger chunk in your mouth at one time.
Yeah, I think it depends on what you're going to do with those.
Exactly. Yeah, I agree.
If you're going to if you're going to let them sit in sugar for like 2-3 days, it's a great way to do it because I think if you just zest it, it's going to break down and it's going to be too small. So that makes perfect sense for that kind of job. But, you know, to me, I think the most important part is to make sure you don't get any of that white pith in there. Because that white pith on grapefruit is very...
Just add more sugar.
No.
What
exactly, no. There's a reason why no.
Exactly no.
So thank you for that, Brittany Bartleben, chef, pastry chef at the Dahlia Bakery and Dahlia Lounge. One thing I wanted to mention, you know, we're coming up on Carmageddon. And one of the things that our marketing team has done is come up with 99 reasons to stay downtown. And some of these are little bonuses, like you'll get a discount here or there, but others are just fun little takes on the reasons. Have you seen the list, Brittany?
I have seen the list.
Yeah. I have seen the list as well.
It's a study in fantastic pun work.
Very French. Yeah. Totally
my favorite is Crash Test Yummies.
Yeah.
happening at all of our joints. Palace Kitchen, for example, is going to have Sit and Stay Tanqueray Gin Martinis, Bertha's Belvedere Vodka Martinis, I can't even say that one on the air. Tanaka-san is going to have demolition dumpling piles, and we're going to have honker potsticker plates, a tunnel of power. So we have all sorts of fun little promotions going on during this coming Friday, or yesterday, actually, the 11th of January through the 11th of February. 99 reasons to stay downtown. If you want to find out more, you can find them all on our website, Tom Douglas, or on our Twitter page. Or
this is the perfect time to try your hotels downtown. This is the perfect time to stay downtown and actually discover your city.
Mm-hmm. Or and just then, put off driving in traffic. Everyone's in traffic. Instead, have a little bit of an earlier dinner and a cocktail, and then drive home.
We open at 5 p.m. just when you come out of the office.
We just don't want to be, Chef and I just don't want to be too lonely down here all by ourselves.
That's right. We don't want to be looking at you guys stuck on the freeway because that's ridiculous.
All right, up next, it's time for Food for Thought Tasty Trivia on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. We are back in the Seattle kitchen on Cairo Radio. It's the Hot Stove Society. Time for Food for Thought Tasty Trivia. I'm your host with some, Tom Douglas, and then there's the host with the most, Terry Rotaro, the chef in the chapeau.
And Katie with the rest.
It's time for our Food for Thought Tasty Trivia Challenge. Tina, tell us about this challenge and who's going to... Well, I know if you're doing the asking, KDO generally wins.
I hope so.
It's a woman thing.
Yeah, I like to throw the quiz a little bit to Katie if I have the opportunity. All right, here's how it works. You each get 5 food-related trivia questions. Whoever gets the most correct is the winner. Whoever gets the least correct is obviously the loser. And that loser has to give some valuable prize away to somebody, either in our studio audience or another fan of our show, maybe from our social media. Today, you're playing for 2 wonderful people in our audience because they both have birthdays today. Jim and Terry will be our lucky winners. They will receive something from one of you losers today.
Well, there's 2 of them, so they're going to get 2 prizes. So.
All right, 2 losers. Right. All right. So, Chef Terry, if you lose the quiz today, what will you give to Jim and Terry?
Well, I think I'm going to give them brunch for 2 at Luke. I don't think they've done that yet.
Lovely. Miss Katie O, what will you give away should you lose today?
A $50 gift card to Molly Moon's homemade ice cream.
Delicious. Chef Tom Douglas, on the rare occasion that you lose this quiz. What would you give away to Jim or Terry?
I would give away a $100 gift card to the Palace Kitchen restaurant that's now taking reservations.
What?
You know, for 24 years we did not take reservations, and now we are for the first time.
I am blown away right now.
Yeah. You are taking reservations at the Palace now?
Yeah.
Oh, I can't just walk in anymore?
Oh, sure you can.
Okay.
But no one's going to see you.
That's exactly the answer.
No table for
you. No problem. You can walk in.
See
you might be waiting.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye, Chef Terry. All right, you guys, who would like to go first today?
I'll start.
Chef, what is the technique for removing the browned bits from a pan to flavor sauces, soups, and gravies?
Well, if you've been listening to the show, we've talked about this a couple of times already. Deglazing.
Correct. Nicely done. The soaking of a fruit in a flavored liquid so it penetrates the fruit is called what?
Macerating.
Wow, he knows his cooking techniques.
He sure does.
This chef.
Especially when they're French.
Here's one for you. Here's one for
right
you,
away.
Chef.
Right away. We got to go there.
What American city produces most of the egg rolls sold in grocery stores in the United States? Is it Houston, Texas, Denver, Colorado, or Albuquerque, New Mexico?
I'm going to go with Denver, Colorado.
The answer is actually Houston, Texas.
Okay.
No. Chef, true or false, there is no difference between blanching and parboiling. Is that true or false?
There is no difference? Yes, there is a difference.
That's correct answer. The answer is false. But yes, that's correct. What is the preservation method called that cooks food and preserves it in its own fat?
Confit.
All French terms, huh? Yep. That was 4
that
out
was
of 5.
Today. That was a
very well done.
Whoa, I'm so glad I started.
All right, Katie, you're next. Okay. To bard a roast means to do what to it?
To bard a roast. Is that when you make incisions and stuff it with things? Is that barding? No, that's larding. Barty.
You want to phone a friend?
I know.
I feel like the audience knows.
Everyone is like feeling very strongly.
Does anybody in the audience knows? Raise your hand if you do.
Wrapping it.
What are you offering? Wait, hold on, hold on. What are you offering from Molly Moon to this gentleman if he wants to help you?
Well, he's also about to win a prize because he's our prize contestant winner. So whatever, he wins no matter what. Wrapping it in fat.
Correct. Yes.
I'm giving that to Jim. I cheated. He's so smart.
All right, Katie, question number two. Mm-hmm. What makes broth different from stock?
What makes broth different from stock? I use those terms
one
indiscriminately.
Begins with a B.
Yeah. And one begins with S. I'm going to say the addition of vegetables. Is that what makes them different?
No.
What is it? Tiri?
One is roasted and one is boiled.
Nope.
No?
Not what we're looking for, anyway. Broth is made from meat, with meat, not bones. That's the answer. Broth is made from meat, not bones.
The rich people make the broth. The poor people make the stock.
Interesting.
Yeah.
All right.
I got it.
Great.
I know where I belong.
Katie, question number three. Mm-hmm. What is a Bombay duck? Is it a cocktail, a type of hen, a fish, or a type of gin?
A Bombay duck. I don't know, but it sounds like a delicious cocktail.
It does, doesn't it? It's actually a fish.
It's a fish! I bet it's a delicious fish.
And a really bad cocktail.
And a really bad cocktail.
It definitely is a bad duck.
Katie, question number four for you. What is the difference between roasting and baking? You have some options. There's no difference at all. Baking is only for cakes and pies, or roasting uses higher heat.
I always think of roasting as a higher heat method, but baking. Can't you bake a fish in salt? These are very difficult for me today. I'm going to go with my first instinct and just say whatever it was that I was going to say. What was that?
Well, it wasn't correct.
Okay. I felt like it was the fair thing to do because everyone started making noises and I was like, oh, I'm clearly making the wrong choice.
A lot of wincing in the audience.
A lot of wincing.
The answer is there's actually no difference between roasting and baking. Katie, what type of knife should you use to dice carrots? Paring knife, chef's knife, or utility knife?
A chef's knife.
Correct. Katie, that was 2 out of 5 correct.
Wow.
Not your best day.
No, it's certainly
not. Not your best.
It certainly was not.
It's okay.
Douglas.
Tom, in order to win everything, you have to get 5 correct.
Okay.
Are you ready for it?
Yes. Last week we said that and he did that.
Your first question, Chef Douglas. Frenching is the process of what?
Kissing.
I knew you were going to say that. Yep. That's what we're looking for. Is it adding cream, wrapping a pastry, or cleaning bones of fat and meat?
Number 3.
Correct. And kissing. Chef, how many teaspoons are in a cup? 8, 14, 12, or 16?
Teaspoons or tablespoons?
Teaspoons in a cup. 8, 14, 12, or 16?
Well, 16. So I thought it was 16 tablespoons. But.
Yeah, you're right. It's 16 tablespoons. The process of baking a pie crust before adding filling is called what?
Par baking. Blind baking.
Blind baking is correct. That's 3 out of 3. You have 2 left.
Wow.
What kind of food preparation comes from the French word fondre, which means to melt?
Fondue.
Hey!
Absolutely.
Where were you all about 2 minutes ago?
Oh, that was hilarious. Oh, where were you?
Chef Tom, that was 4 for 4. You have 1 left to get a perfect score. Why do saltwater fish generally have thicker bones than freshwater fish?
Because they have to swim farther.
Nope. Salt water is more buoyant than fish freshwater, and so it can support the fish and the heavier skeletons.
Exactly what I said.
Chef Tom and Chef Tier, you have tied. Not Chef Katie has been the loser today, but the big winners are Jim and Terry, who receive a $50 gift certificate for Molly Moon's ice cream.
And which one wants that? And I'll give the Palace Kitchen to the other, unless you both want Molly Moon.
They both probably want both.
You can have one or the other. Jim, your choice.
I'll take your gifts.
Okay, Palace Kitchen. for $100. Now taking reservations.
And happy birthday to both of you.
If you want to be part of the show, you can send us a note on Facebook or Twitter at Seattle Kitchen. You're listening to us on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. The show is produced by Tina Noll at Large Media. Our associate producer is Sarah Leibovitz. And our sound engineer is Sean Don't Call Me Del Torre. If you want to be part of our studio audience, go to hotstovesociety.com and buy tickets, you cheapskate, for only $15. Comes with breakfast. Mm-hmm. Also, remember, if you miss any episode of Seattle Kitchen, you can subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, or download the Cairo Radio app and search for Seattle Kitchen.
Thanks for listening.
Have a great weekend.